Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:05 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is Friday, February 22nd, so it is the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. What I would like to start off and talk to you about this week is China. The renminbi is strengthening through the 200-day moving average. That is a clear sign that the Chinese administration have given some due consideration to the outlook for the trade talks that are going on with the USA. If we look at everything else that's been happening this week, that is also supportive of the view that there is going to be a trade deal. Steve Mnuchin came out just before I started recording to say that there had been an agreement reached on the outlook for the currency. So the last thing the USA wants to see is the renminbi weakening through 7. And we've now started to see that it is in fact strengthening through the moving average. So that is at least more than a short-term bounce. We haven't yet seen a higher reaction low, really. So that's something that we would need to see in order to really confirm that the renminbi is going to strengthen from here. But it would at least now need to sustain a move below 6.8 to really question that we're not still in a renminbi demand-dominated environment. Then when we look at what's going on in terms of the commodity complex, we've seen today, or at least this week, that the copper price has broken upwards in a pretty emphatic manner. It was up another 4 cents, 4.7 cents in here today, but that's clearing the 7-month range. It's back above the trend mean, and this is looking like a very clear breakout. Well, when we think about the industrial resources, obviously China looms large, considering that it isn't just the largest consumer but also figures very significantly in demand growth forecasts. So when you get copper breaking out in such a dynamic manner, then I think that it does warrant sitting up and paying attention to exactly what's going on in China. Additionally, the A-share index has also broken on the upside in here this week, and it was up in a rather dynamic manner in here today. So now it has cleared the region of the trend mean. It had broken its sequence of lower rally highs last week. It's followed through on the upside this week. This is starting to look like a reflation trade in China. The one thing that has been very clear with regard to the Chinese market over the course of the last year has been one that the A-share, the FTSE A600 Banks Index bottomed about 6 months ago. And we had a higher reaction low in January, and now it is back testing the upper side of its range, and it is above its trend mean. So we're starting to see relative strength in the banking sector. But of course, this is the state-owned banking sector, which is essentially an arm of the government. All of the tightening that has gone on over the course of the last few years has been focused on the shadow banking sector. There have been successive avenues for liquidity cut off from the shadow banking sector, with the result that the net size of the shadow banks has contracted and gone negative over the course of the last 18 months. That has at least offered the opportunity for the Chinese administration to declare job done. And there is increasing evidence that they are probably going to start to stimulate once more. So I think that is what we're starting to see with the banks. It's what we're starting to see with the H-share index. It's what we're seeing with the A-share index, and also with copper. So that's a rather positive turn of events, because China has been underperforming for more than a year already. It has been largely discounted from the expectations for the provision of liquidity to fuel global growth, but we're now starting to see that it is turning back to a position of outperformance. That is having a very significant knock-on effect. So When, for example, we look at the MSCI Emerging Markets ETF, then it has also broken its sequence of lower rally highs over the last year, and it is firming from the region of the trend mean. And of course, China represents a very significant weighting within that ETF. Tencent and Alibaba represent the two largest constituents at about 9% of the index. Then you look at China Construction Bank, China Mobile, ICBC, Ping An, and then that gives another at least another 5 or 6%. And when we start to move down, then we're moving into smaller constituents, but plenty of constituents. So Baidu and Bank of China also rounding out the top 18 holdings. So what happens in terms of Tencent and Alibaba is going to have a significant effect on the outlook for the emerging markets index. But it's highly unlikely that shares like Alibaba are going to go down while you have a reflation trade going on at home. And Alibaba has broken now back above its trend mean and was up in rather dynamic ter in a dynamic manner in here today. Tencent, which led on the downside, had also been leading on the rebound, and it is firming from the region of the trend mean. So this is also positive. Well, all of this is starting to look like a reflation trade for China. Now let's think a little bit about the trade war and exactly what it was that really led to the animus that has really been part of the relationship between the USA and China over the last 18 months. On the one hand, it is that globalization has probably benefited China more than any other country. On top of that, it was the globalization was effectively, or allowing China into the WTO, was a bet that they could civilize China, that they could bring China into the fold of the OECD by increasing wealth in the country. And there has been something of a magic number over the years that when countries reach about $3,500 in terms of GDP per capita, that democracy flourishes. But that was very flawed logic. And what has been completely unexpected is that the Communist Party would persist for this long and that they would refuse to adopt the social democracy type of way of thinking that the West had. In fact, they're going the other way. They're getting increasingly more authoritarian. So that has contributed to a backlash against globalization, not least because the bet that was taken was, well, the wager was on the livelihoods of millions of middle-class workers, particularly those that depended on manufacturing. Manufacturing, the role of manufacturing in the economy has been completely underappreciated by the powers that be for the simple reason that it has historically played the key role of providing a middle-class lifestyle to people that are less well-educated. And by removing manufacturing from the social fabric, well, then that has shoved people either back into education to improve their lot, but more likely than not, it's that they've had to take lower paid jobs. Doesn't mean they're working any less. And in fact, you have low unemployment in a significant number of countries, particularly the UK and the USA. But the jobs that are being done are paying less. And the growth of the services industry tends to be rather amorphous because somebody working in Google is working in the services industry, somebody working at cleaning toilets in a building or acting is also in the service industry. They're obviously at completely different sides of the equation. Of course, by getting rid of the manufacturing sector, it also reduced the influence of the private sector in the economy, which then threw focus onto the public sector. Public sector spending has increased measurably. The reason that public sector spending has been, or how it's been funded, has been with debt. We've been in a massive disinflationary period for the global economy over the course of the last 40 years. That has seen bond yields compress remarkably from 16% to the current 2.6%. And we have a base formation in evidence here. If when we look at this chart, then it's still ranging. There has been a range underway since 2011, and that has been primarily below the 3% level. The move that we saw above 3% at the end of last year failed, and that is now very clearly below the trend mean. We're going to have to see it sustain a move above the trend mean in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Well, what does this weakness in the yield and the strength in treasury prices tell us? One thing that we know for certain is that there is going to be an enormous amount of debt issuance over the course of the next 3 years. That's particularly true in the treasury market and indeed in the corporate market. There are a lot of leverage loans that also need to be refinanced over the course of the next couple of years. So there is the very real prospect that there is going to be a lot of indigestion in the bond markets over the course of the next few years, and yet yields are continuing to compress. So we can therefore only conclude one thing, that this strength that we're seeing in bond prices, with a very clear, I think, wedging pattern now evident on the bond price. It's been up one day and down the other. I've just outlined what the bearish condition is, but of course the bullish condition for bonds is that the Federal Reserve is done with reducing the size of its balance sheet, and that they are done with raising interest rates. That is a testament to the fact that we are still pretty late in the cycle. So what the market is now betting on is that the Federal Reserve is essentially going to stand pat, and that is potentially giving asset prices room in which to rally further. Eventually, the Federal Reserve will have to act against the potential for overheating in the market. That's a realistic possibility if the market now, or if investors conclude that the Federal Reserve cannot raise interest rates against a background where wages continue to trend higher. And of course, this is not simply a US phenomenon, but that it is happening all over the world. So with rising wages and central banks that appear to be either resistant to the idea of continuing to tighten policy, or also feeling inhibited in their attempts to do so because of the fragility of the markets and the reliance of the stock market on the provision of liquidity, well, that represents an inflationary issue. Most particularly when we see that we have advocates of modern monetary theory proliferating. We even had in here this week Bernie Sanders announcing that he is going to run for president once more. And that's ambitious considering he's 78 years old. But that, I think, is certainly not going to that's not going to stop him from running. His economics coordinator from his last run has been one of the clearest champions of modern monetary theory, and the central premise of modern monetary theory is that deficits don't matter, that the only thing that could inhibit the ability of the government to increase its debt load or to print more money is inflation, and that In the absence of inflation, there is no limit on how much money a government can spend, particularly if it is issuing debt in its own currency. Well, the major economies of the world have that privilege. Quite whether they will continue to have that privilege if they abuse it, remains to be seen. I don't think that is something that these proponents of modern monetary theory generally tend to take into account. When we look at then, therefore, at the outlook for the bond market, the fact that the Federal Reserve is being, at least investors are concluding that they are done with raising interest rates, and the fact that China is engaged in a reflationary trade, then I think it's important to cast the trade war rhetoric and discussions in that on that basis. What is it that the USA wants? Well, they want the renminbi to be firmer. They want the trade balance between the USA and China to be more even. And then they want some verification that the unfair support of domestic industry from China is and the technology transfer is going to end. Well, the first two are relatively easy to achieve, and we're starting to see that commodity prices are rising and that the renminbi is strengthening. So there are good faith, I think, efforts underway. Quite whether China is going to truly avoid or give up on technology transfer, let alone the industrialization of industrial espionage, is another question entirely. But what does China want out of these negotiations? Well, they clearly want to remain on the trajectory of development that they've been on for the last 30 years. They also have a very clear stated ambitions to become the most significant global economy in the world and to, in fact, become the global hegemon. Well, they are probably, despite the progress that they've made, they're not quite there yet. There are two things that China does not yet have that are really required before they can start to take on the USA's dominance. Well, the first one is energy independence, or even a path towards it. Well, they're building a daisy chain of military bases from the Persian Gulf to China. Well, the very clear ambition, therefore, would be to provide security for their energy supply, and that's largely inevitable. The fact that China is building aircraft carriers, that is only with one goal, and that is to project power internationally. So that's the obvious stated objective. Well, it's obviously not too difficult to start counting aircraft carriers. China currently has one and is building a second. The USA has 12. So China is going to continue building those. They're not ready to challenge the USA on a naval footing. Then, when we look at the fact that China is not energy independent, well, obviously they have to secure their supply chain, but they also have to figure out what to do if that supply chain were in fact interdicted. So China is investing heavily in battery technology, and that is as much about dominating a new sector on the global front as it is about national security. So, China is absolutely going to continue to pursue battery technology for the simple reason that it aligns very clearly with their long-term objective of global dominion. Anything that gets in the way of that long-term objective is going to face obviously some reconsideration. Therefore, I think it is very likely that China is going to agree to some form of deal. It's going to be hard won. It's obviously going to take a lot of negotiation, and they're not going to want to give any more than they possibly have to. But it is quite likely that China is going to agree to a deal now because it needs further time in which to think, prepare for its longer term objectives. When we think about Made in China 2025 and the 1,000 talents programs, well, those are decade long in nature, and we're still 6 years out from the 2025 objective. Their objective of becoming the global superpower, the number one global superpower, is slated for 2040 or approximately 2050. If they engage in a trade war today, which retards growth, well, then that objective is going to get lengthened. So I think it is quite likely that China is going to agree to some form of at least some form of trade deal with the USA. Now, when we look at the S&P 500, it has been rallying very persistently since December, and it is now right in the region of the highs from October, November, and December. I think this is a natural area where we could anticipate some pause and consolidation, and the index has paused over the course of the last 4 days. One thing that I am rather reminded of is the period back in 2012 and 2013. If we look at what happened back then, we had a rather significant pullback in the period between about September and November. Then the market started to pull back again in the last week of the year, and everyone was getting worried that we were in for another downdraft, that there was also some concerns about liquidity, whether we were in fact going to get another bout of quantitative easing. Then on the first, well, it was the 31st of December, and then through the 2nd of January, the market broke out, and by the second week of the year was at new recovery highs. Then it persisted to rally for an additional 4 to 5 weeks, and only had a very mild pullback before extending the advance all the way through to May. Well, one of the things that we got towards the end of February was news of QE3, and I think that there are some clear parallels today, that we started to see this rally start to really take off at the period right after Christmas. It has persisted for the last 2 months. What are we seeing now is the potential for an additional reflation trade. That is being led by China and by the perception that the Federal Reserve is done with raising interest rates, but also because the Europeans are starting to sound like they are going to provide additional liquidity. So that is also important. Now, when we look at the size of central bank balance sheets, not just over the last couple of weeks, but over the last few years, it's been trending higher in a very persistent manner. Part of the reason why we've had this big uptick in volatility in 2018 is because it was trending down. Now, if that index were to move to a new low, well, then that would represent a very significant headwind to the liquidity-fueled bull market that we've had. But so far, it has held the rebound posted over the course of the last 6 weeks. So I think that's a rather important factor. As long as this index is not contracting, then it's likely to represent at least a neutral outlook for the market. But potentially, if it were to start pushing back above 20 trillion, well, then we would be very clearly in a liquidity-fueled advance again, and that would help to inflate asset prices. The European stock market has been under a great deal of pressure over the course of the last few years. It really hasn't gone anywhere since 2015. There's been a lot of up and down, but it's in fact still below the peak value in early 2015. We know what the problems are. There is a demographic Excuse me. Well, there is a demographic issue in Europe. They don't have enough of young people. But there is a democratic issue, which is much more important, in that there have been measures put in place in Europe to create a federal union that people have not voted for. That the entire austerity regime that was implemented has only achieved a modest reordering of debt to GDP ratios. The issues with the banking sector are unresolved. The index is a fraction of where it was over the course of the over the last decade. There have been so many bankruptcies and consolidations that the number of constituents within the index has contracted significantly. That represents a significant headwind. Eventually, you're going to get enough consolidation that the bad loans will become less of an issue, but that is an incredibly long-term problem. The fact that you cannot write off the loans because the creditors are in the north of the continent and the debtors are in the south of the continent, well, that's something that is rather difficult to overcome. So that's certainly something that is going to weigh on the European markets. But what it effectively means is that they are going to have a very difficult time raising interest rates, and that is really quite similar to what we've seen with Japan. Japan also did not get the banks to write off their bad loans, and in fact, they're still sitting with those bad loans. When we look at the Japanese banking sector, and it certainly helps if you type in the correct ticker, the topics banks have been rather moribund over the course of the last year. They failed to sustain the move towards 200, and this continues to look like a very long range. But considering that the index was at a rather extraordinary high back in the late 1980s, this looks like a very long-term sleeper base because they're still sitting with a very difficult balance sheet environment. There is a real possibility that Europe is going the same, going down the same deflationary route as Japan. The austerity regime has, however, helped to stabilize the currency. So the euro is at just about steady below this 114 area. The reality is that Europe needs a weaker currency, and that if the ECB engages in quantitative easing once more, and I believe that that is quite likely, I think in fact there's a real argument that they never stopped, well, that is going to act as a headwind for the euro. In nominal terms, the stock market does tend to do better in those types of circumstances. But we have to now start to think about the fact that we are transitioning from monetary stimulus to fiscal stimulus. That is certainly what we've started to see in the USA. We're starting to see it also in places like the UK and France and Italy. The size of Germany's surplus has is projected to continue to contract, and that is less because of anticipation about the outlook for growth and more because of increasing spending. Then, of course, you have the fact that China is probably going to engage in both monetary and fiscal stimulus. India is in the process of trying to buy an election for Modi, so that is additional stimulus. So we are at the point here where we are probably going to have both evidence of monetary and fiscal stimulus. And that is potentially bad news for the debt markets. But as long as governments are willing to buy their own bonds, then it's quite likely to try and keep a lid on inflationary pressures. Well, there is a good reason, therefore, why gold should be doing better in this kind of environment. That governments are increasingly spending money they don't have, and that in the process they are attempting to devalue their currencies. Well, gold has rallied all the way back up to the upper side of its range since the low back in August, and it pulled back in a reasonably dynamic manner yesterday, and it was in a mildly positive territory in here today. Considering that $1,350 represents an area of resistance, then I think it is quite likely we are going to get some consolidation. So far, the reactions we've seen have been in the order of about $25. And those that we saw in October, November were a bit bigger than that and came out at about $45. I think it is quite likely we're going to get some consolidation in this area. Generally speaking, precious metals are best bought, and in fact, commodities generally are best bought following reactions. They do tend to have choppy uptrends, and that when they do pull back, they can pull back in a very violent manner. Well, what that suggests is that they are best bought following reactions. That is, or it's almost like adopting a baby steps trading strategy within an uptrend, that fading the significant advances relative to the trend mean and increasing positions on reversions back towards the mean. I think there is a realistic possibility we are going to see gold breaking on the upside in due course, though perhaps not for the next few weeks. But when we start to look around the world, then there is a very clear potential that we are going to see budget deficits and the quantity of debt accelerating higher, that the bull market in bonds could end with an issuing climax. We also have to, I think, start to pay attention to the fact that when bull markets do end, they generally don't end because of demand evaporating. It's much more normal to think that bull markets, in fact, end because supply increases. And I think that's a very logical way of thinking about it, because the longer prices rise for, the greater the confidence people have in prices continuing to rise. The strategy that works best is to buy the dips. That's exactly what people have done with bonds recently. Then that's going to persist until the buy the dip strategy no longer works. When you see that prices have been rising for a long time, it encourages competition. So people start to list their companies, because the best time to list your companies when you think you can get more than you think it's worth. So what we're certainly seeing is there's going to be a great deal of bond issuance over the course of the next 3 years. That has the potential to create some indigestion. There are likely to be at least some downgrades from a rather bloated lower range of the investment grade market to high yield. What we've definitely seen, though, over the course of the last few weeks has been that high yield spreads have narrowed from over 500 basis points to 400. That has pretty much unwound all of the overextension relative to the trend mean. So then this is about where, if this spread is going to bounce, then I think it is quite unlikely it's going to contract below 400 basis points. Well, what that suggests is that we're potentially now in a similar situation to what we were at in early 2015. That we've had the initial pop on the upside. Now we could potentially see a first step above the base and subsequently see prices sustain a move above the 600 basis point level. Those sorts of moves in the market have generally been associated with market stress. We certainly had stress in the latter portion of last year. If high yield spreads start to expand once more, then that is going to be at least a coincident, if not a lead indicator, for future issues in the stock market, but so far we don't have the evidence yet to confirm that the spread has found support. But it is quite likely that we are going to see some indigestion in terms of market issuance, that investors are now demanding a somewhat higher yield or even tighter covenants. The pace of cov-lite lending has been robust over the course of the last few years. It's very similar to the kind of condition that we had back in 2006 and 7. The one big difference today is that banks are considerably less levered. What that really helps to drive home is that obviously banks as liquidity providers are very sensitive to liquidity conditions. So they benefit when liquidity is expanding and they pull back violently when it isn't. That's certainly what we saw in the latter part of last year. It also helps to explain the rebound that we've seen so far. Well, the S&P 500 Banks Index popped on the upside last week or yesterday, and today and yesterday it was a little bit weaker. So we're right in the region of the trend mean. This is exactly where we would need to see the index starting to firm additionally from here. So I think that is certainly something that we need to pay attention to. Banks, as liquidity providers, are often a lead indicator for what we can anticipate from the wider market. This has been a liquidity-fueled bull market. The fact that the regional banks are back above their trend mean and have broken their sequence of lower rally highs is positive. What it's suggesting is that the US economy is still reasonably, I think, firm in here. But what it also highlights is that the US is not the epicenter of risk on this occasion. That when we look at where the epicenters of risk are, they reside clearly in China and in Europe. It is therefore in Europe and China that we need to pay particular attention to the outlook for liquidity provision. I think the good news, at least this week, is that the outlook for that liquidity provision is improving. So that is certainly something that we can look to as a sort with some form of optimism. But the fact that gold has been so firm suggests that investors are hedging their exposure to the potential for currency wars. I haven't looked at the Dow gold ratio for a while, but it has had a meaningful pullback. One of the things that I find most interesting about this ratio is the fact that the distance between the peaks corresponds so closely with the Kondratiev wave that we generally get these distances between the peak somewhere in the order of about 35 years. And the Kondratiev wave is somewhere around 40 years. The fact that the bond bull market has persisted since 1980 and we are now in 2019 is corresponding with about 40 years. So I think this, when we think about the very long-term cycle, the outlook for the stock market is to continue to outperform. But gold is rallying in here, and that has contributed to it outperforming the stock market over the first part of this year. Well, that is obviously a logical inconsistency. So then if we go back and look at history, even in the context of a secular bull market, there have been plenty of examples of rather lengthy periods where gold has outperformed. That is particularly true in the 1950s, when these were multi-year pauses. So I think that there is the potential that we are potentially entering one of those now, where gold has the real potential to not just appreciate in a number of other currencies, but also to become a favored asset class. That's obviously conditional on it being able to sustain a move up and out of this base formation. But the base formation has been underway now for 6 years already. What I find particularly interesting is when we start to look at gold in other currencies. So it was at new all-time highs in Australian dollars this week. When we look at it in Indian rupees, then this is also a very meaningful move. It's breaking up out of the most recent range and testing the highs from back in 2012. When we look at it in Brazilian real, then we're also looking at a market that continues to look bullish. Then, because the euro is at a risk here, then gold has been rallying very persistently and is back testing the 1200 euro level. It's cleared the $1,000 level when we look at pounds, and it does look like it's just consolidating in the region of £1,000. Well, even when we look at comparatively firm currencies like the yen, then gold has done little more than range over the course of the last 6 years. So I think these are really rather significant developments, that gold is appreciating in a significant number of currencies, particularly against some of the stronger currencies. It's obviously much firmer against some of the weaker currencies. So there is an increasing argument that gold is a hedge against devaluing currencies, and that the number of fiat currencies that are going to be devalued is likely to increase significantly over the course of the next few years. When we get down to the really very basic argument that these massive debt accumulations that have occurred over the course of a 40-year bull market are unlikely to ever be paid back, and certainly not in today's dollars, pounds, euros, yen, or renminbi. Rather, that it is much more expedient for governments to flog their currencies, to aggressively devalue their currencies, and that is very much on the cards when we think about the fact that a substantial quantity of the world's population, upwards of 30% of the population, are going to be voting this year in elections. And there's a real possibility that we're going to see that it is populist candidates start to come to the fore. So when we think about the next US presidential election, it's quite likely that there are going to be two populist candidates running against each other. So that is likely to result in the continuation of the populist trend. We don't quite yet know what's going to happen with the UK. But one thing that is looking increasingly likely is that the electorate is going to be betrayed, or at least they're going to feel like they've been betrayed. And that is likely to fuel a lurch to the fringes. So the pound is steadying right now because of the anticipation that the exit from the EU is going to be delayed, which effectively takes the no deal scenario off the table. Any deal that is negotiated is going to quite likely result in some form of customs union, which is not at all what people thought they were voting for. It's effectively probably going to result in membership in all but name. That is going to represent a massive betrayal of the trust of the electorate. So there is a real possibility that we are going to see a further lurch to the fringes of the political spectrum. The next general election in the UK could quite likely be a face-off between Jeremy Corbyn and Rees-Mogg. Well, if that's the case, then we're going to get two very different versions of populism being put before the people, and it is very much a coin toss as to which one will then come out on top. This is a very clear risk. So I think that there is certainly scope in the near term for the pound to continue to rally, but it's still a very risky environment. Well, obviously, then if we do get a somewhat stronger currency, that's not especially great news for the stock market. European stocks have tended to rally in nominal terms because the currency has been weaker. Well, if the pound starts to strengthen further, then that could start to contribute to greater volatility in terms of the FTSE 250, for example. But that's more of a domestic play and therefore less heavily influenced by currency than the FTSE 100. And the FTSE 100 is right in the region of the trend mean right now. I think it's also worth reminding ourselves that when we think about the outlook for the stock market, then it's not like we're thinking about Kraft Heinz, which was down over 20% today, but rather about the outlook for large cap growth. And that's particularly true of companies that have adopted the subscription business model. So if we start to think about the fact that if we look around the world, we know what the problems are. And we know that gold is starting to do better, and that is effectively a hedge against the worst impulses of government to devalue their currencies. But then we have technology, and technology is the solution to a lot of the world's problems. That has always been the case. And deflation is inherently, or excuse me, technology is inherently disinflationary because it's always about doing more with less. So the adoption of a subscription business model by the technology sector has turned highly cyclical businesses into almost like the modern equivalent of a consumer staple. Because when people look at Microsoft and the way that it is now pricing its Windows service, that's about as staple a form of expenditure for most people as buying food. It's almost indispensable. So that is, I think, straddling the outlook for both technology and consumer staples or consumer discretionary. That's, I think, one of the true transformations that we're getting in terms of technology, that it is not simply about the new forms of technology that are coming to the market, but the adoption of a new business model to complement them. So the subscription business model is being expanded exponentially. Amazon, with its Prime service, is obviously a clear beneficiary from that, and the share is right in the region of its trend mean. Netflix has been able to spend billions because it's been able to go to the debt markets and exhibit the revenue reliability it gets from its subscriptions. So that has helped to fuel this rebound we've seen over the course of the last 6 weeks, or I guess 7 weeks at this stage. This continued advance we're seeing is going to be liquidity fueled. If we see that the yield curve spread starts to contract, well, that would be an indication of additional tightness. It's currently at 16 basis points, and it has been largely inert over the course of the last 3 months. We can also look at the consistency of the trend, and that each of the ranges generally has been in the order of about 10 basis points. So when it eventually breaks below 10 basis points, the next stop will be zero. Now, that is likely to be contingent on the outlook for the 2 year, much more so than the 10 year. So when we look at the 2 year yield, it has now pulled back below the region of the trend mean. There is no doubting the fact that it did accelerate higher from the end of 2017 to the end of 2018, and now it is encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean. If the yield continues to contract, then particularly if it does so faster than the 10-year, then that's going to at least allay fears about an inverted yield curve. So what happens with this chart is, I think, going to be of pivotal importance to the outlook for a global reflation. When we think about what can drive the productivity growth in the global economy, well, it's certainly within the transportation sector, the energy sector, the healthcare sector. These are obviously the primary sectors where we're starting to see enormous growth happening. That the quantitative easing has had incredible distortionary effects, particularly in fixed income, but it has allowed the liquidity to flow through the private equity sector into a lot of speculative ventures. Some of those are going to be successful. There are equally going to be many that are not successful. So I think eventually interest rates are going to become tighter. It is I'm often reminded of Warren Buffett's. You don't really know who's been swimming naked until the tide goes out, and there are going to be a substantial number of the unicorns that have evolved over the course of the last few years eventually end up worthless. That could potentially be true for Uber in particular. They have employed vast numbers of people. When we look at the fact that it is unemployment has been at least a coincident indicator for future recessions, well, it did pop on the upside at the beginning of this year because of the government slowdown, or sorry, shutdown, and people will certainly be watching now to see that it goes back down from that 4% level. If a company like Uber eventually goes bust, then that is going to free up an enormous number of workers, and that could in fact be one of the causal factors in slowing consumer demand. What I refer to as the Tracy family indicator, in terms of my wife's internet business, where she's clearly selling consumer discretionary items, the best-selling item is a box with an LED inside, so that it makes when somebody wants to pop the question in a dimly lit restaurant, they can open the box and it shines this light on the diamond ring and makes it well, it makes a cheap ring look a lot more expensive. And that has been Amazon's choice for much of the last year. Well, it's also a very clear discretionary item. And I think it's quite obvious that when demand for it starts to wane, well, that is going to be a clear indication that the consumer is in trouble. So that has not been the case at all. In fact, the demand has done nothing but rise. So that is, I think, representative of continued strength in the global economy and in the US economy. What that suggests to me is that we have been through a very profound medium-term correction. We are not out of the woods yet. There is still the possibility that we have seen the peak in the consumer discretionary sector, or that we are moving into a much lengthier ranging phase. But as long as the lows hold, we're still in a range. And I think with the potential for additional liquidity provision coming from an increasingly large number of central banks, then and coupled with the fact that industrial resources are starting to do better, that is, I think, particularly true for Australia, where the ASX 200 has been resurgent over the course of the last 2 months. The resources sector in Australia has been doing substantially better as well. That has been fueled not only by the rebound in industrial resources and precious metals, but also because of the weakness of the Australian dollar. Well, it was a little steadier in here today, but the Aussie dollar is going to at least need to break its sequence of lower rally highs in order to really question that we're not still in a supply-dominated environment. If China is, in fact, reflating, it should be positive for just about all commodity producers. And these are, I think, rather significant developments that are happening right now. I think in the absence of clear evidence to the contrary, I think we have to at least give the benefit of the doubt now to a global reflation trade that is starting to take off. And that could contribute to these very volatile ranges we've seen on markets being resolved on the upside. Well, if we are late in the medium-term cycle, then there is the possibility that this medium-term advance is going to end in an acceleration. And there is the potential that if these broad stock market indices, which have been ranging for more than a year, break on the upside, that we could give some additional credence to that particular outcome. The other thing that I'm rather conscious of as we move through the first half of 2019 is that it is the third year of the presidential election cycle. The first half of the third year is generally when we get a wobble in the stock market, and it is in the second half of the year that the Federal Reserve starts to ease up on its tightening measures. Well, we're already starting to see that. So that could contribute to a much better performance in the second half of this year. And that could even persist through to 2020. Well, if we do get a much better stock market environment, then that is probably what is going to cause the Federal Reserve to tighten further. But they're probably now shying away from that kind of action. So I think there is the possibility here that in the absence of evidence to the contrary, that we could see markets do better from here and move into the very latter stages of this bull market. In fact, with resources starting to do better, with gold starting to attract investors, with tobacco going from very deeply oversold conditions to a position of outperformance, and other defensive sectors doing better, that is all representative of the last stages of a medium-term bull market. So this is certainly a time to be more cautious, but also to be open to the potential that we could get an acceleration as the ultimate ending of this medium-term liquidity-fueled bull market. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and the weekend, I guess, and wish all the best to all of you.